Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Hello, this is Mike Keyes with ID the Future, and today on the show we have the privilege of talking with Sean McDowell. Now, the timing of this interview is important to kind of set you up why we're talking to Sean. This is to celebrate the 10th anniversary of a book that he co-authored with intelligent design theorist William Dembski. It was entitled Understanding Intelligent Design, Everything You Need to Know in Plain Language. Sean, welcome to ID the Future.
Mike, thanks for having me. This is a treat.
All right. So let me just say a few things about Sean, his background, and then we'll get into the interview. So he did work in theology and philosophy, and eventually, in fact, 2014, he earned a PhD in apologetics and worldview studies from Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. So again, he's got training in how to think as a historian, as a theologian, as a philosopher, and of course, Christian apologetics integrates these disciplines. He has been an assistant professor at Biola University, in which he's taught in, you know, teaching historical and theological topics and apologetic topics. And he also does a lot of speaking. So I think that many people don't realize how, especially when you're looking at the natural sciences, there's really two kinds of ways you can do natural science. That's how does nature operate today? Sort of experimental work on cause and effect structure of how things operate. And then there's the question of origins. How did this event happen or what caused it? And when it comes to human history, we're asking origins questions about the human domain, and it's similar in natural history. So as we transition into that, as you were writing this book with William Dembski, Understanding Intelligent Design, how did you see this play out when it comes to the question of the origin of life or the origin of the major kinds of life? How did your training in human history help you to think like a scientist in terms of natural history?
Well, I actually wrote this book in 2008, really 2007, because it came out in 2008 with Dembski. I started my dissertation about 2 years after that, which is where I really started looking in and reading how history was done and studying that for a few years and applying it to my dissertation. So I had already seen abduction at work by reading intelligent design. And then the other way around, I got the history. It's like, oh my goodness, this is the same kind of thinking as we see in the natural sciences. So it was more my application of intelligent design and how science is done applied to history than the other way around.
That's really interesting, because for many of our listeners who maybe have more background in the humanities, they might feel more comfortable with how one draws conclusions in, like, say, human history, but it could go either direction. And I think that's important for people to understand that natural science is not totally separate as a academic discipline from other disciplines. There's a lot of methodological overlap, isn't there?
Oh, I think there is. And also questions of methodological naturalism really come into play, both in history and in science. So in science, clearly, this is something intelligent design proponents talk about all the time. Are intelligent, you know, beings or causes allowed into science? Can we allow there to be an intelligent agent, or is it required that we find naturalistic explanations? Well, this is exactly the same question when you're studying the claims of Jesus.
So, all right, let's open up your book of 2008, Understanding Intelligent Design with Dembski, and I'm looking at the table of contents, and here's one chapter that catches my attention. Chapter 3, The Surprising Truth. What's surprising, Sean?
Well, we started off that chapter by saying the surprising truth is that the evidence for evolution, the evidence for Darwinian evolution, is weak. Now, that's surprising for a lot of people because we're writing to a popular audience. Really, this book was my attempt to partner with William Dembski and just kind of simplify some of the arguments that he's made at the highest level of philosophy and mathematics. So for a lot of people who've read this book, they've seen documentary shows, they've been in science class, they've seen, you know, the Discovery Channel or the Science Channel, and they just kind of assume that evolution is probably true. So we partly wanted to get their attention right out of the gate and just say, you know what? The evidence is weak, or at least it's weaker than maybe you've been led to think.
Right.
So we walk through, you know, we give some quotes by people that always give juicy quotes, like Dawkins and other people like that, who are just saying the evidence is fact, 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 and you're crazy to doubt it. And we say, you know what, maybe there's another story here. So we just walk through some of the common arguments people give for evolution, and really just kind of give the other side so they at least see things are not as black and white as right, they're often right. led to believe.
Now, let's take the next step, Sean, in thinking through your book and celebrating its 10th anniversary and why people might want to pick it up 10 years later. You've established in this early chapter that people should be surprised that the evidence for Darwinism is not as strong as they've been led to think. So that's the negative argument. What about the positive argument? What are some ways that you can communicate to people? On what basis should we believe that the basic kinds of life originated by means of intelligent design rather than through an unguided material process?
Well, in the book, we actually spend the first 5 chapters walking through background information. So what is creationism? What is intelligent design? What are the worldview issues underlying this debate? And what is the design inference? It's really not till we get through the last 5 chapters that we start talking about the evidence itself. Now, we do have a chapter. We start off, of course, talking about irreducible complexity. I think that's a good argument. I've not seen any plausible explanations of a step-by-step naturalistic account of how you get something like the bacterial flagellum. I think Behe was onto something. But I don't think that's the most effective argument in conversation with people, because right, it's right. a little harder to grasp. And it seems distant for them. It's almost like using the ontological argument for the existence of God. People don't fully grasp it. What I found most powerful in terms of design are 2. Number 1 is DNA. And I think people can really intuitively grasp the idea that when you see information and you trace it back to its source, as Stephen Meyer often says, we're able to trace it back to its source, we always find a mind. We always do. So I walk people through and I say, you get a text and it's legible, it comes from a texter. Get a book, it comes from an author. Get a blog, it comes from a blogger. If you come out in the sky and it says, drink Coke, you know it doesn't mean a storm is coming from the east.
Right.
I mean, a pilot or a mind went through and wrote that. Well, we look in the cell and there's more sophistication, more just complexity that's specified than anything humans can invent. I just can't get myself to believe that this happened through a blind material process. That information points towards some kind of author of life. So I found in conversation with people, in particular students, that makes sense to them. And there's often kind of those what you might call aha moments where people get it. Right, second right. is the fine tuning. Now, I know that's not biological, but that's the next part that we go to in the text, not only the origin of the universe, but the fine tuning. And I'll often talk with students and I'll say, imagine that you go exploring and you find an abandoned cabin. And you think it's abandoned, but you walk in and it's got, yes, shoes that fit you. It's got the smell of your favorite meal. You hear your favorite song in the background. You see a jacket that fits you perfectly. You open the fridge, it's the snacks you like. You go to the bathroom, it's all toys you use. Well, eventually you'd say, wait a minute. There's too many factors just right for me for this to be explained by just chance or some other natural force. You don't know who, but someone is expecting your arrival. Well, it's Freeman Dyson who basically said, he goes, man, given all the accidents of physics and astronomy, it almost seems as if someone was expecting our arrival. So to me, when I'm talking with people, I say, just like the information DNA points towards an information giver or a mind, the fine tuning of the universe points towards a fine tuner. Now, of course, this raises a ton of objections, but in terms of people intuitively grasping design, those are the two that I found most effective.
Excellent.
I think the key to communication has always been the same in one sense, although there are some changes in our modern culture. I mean, people who communicate well use illustrations that people grasp. I think that's why Behe's mousetrap really made sense and got so much traction. Mm-hmm. I think illustrations like that, examples, stories that people remember, stick with them and make the points sink in. So oftentimes people who love intelligent design and science give the facts and the evidence behind it, but don't find a way to translate that. So people say, ah, I get it. Those are the hooks that I'm looking for.
Right.
And I think those have really changed in the past 10 years, because we recently had Stephen Meyer on our podcast at Biola. And I asked him about this, and he said, look, the arguments, he goes, we've won the arguments. Now it's a matter of just advancing them and doing real practical research so people see the fruit of the arguments.
Right.
So I think the evidence is there. The key, you know, the one thing that I think has changed in the past 10 years, and I don't necessarily have the answer how to fix this, is what's changed hugely. Well, actually, two things. I take that back. One thing that's changed hugely is the smartphone in the hands of young people. Mm-hmm. And I think when I communicate with them, because they can Google any response and always find somebody smart who disagrees with me, oftentimes in the minds of young people, there's a sense that, like, gosh, if someone disagrees with me, can I know anything with confidence?
Right.
So that's one area that's changed. And I think the intelligent design arguments that work really appeal to people's common sense. And you say, doesn't it make sense when you see text, there's an author? We see information in the cell. Yes, people can raise objections, but doesn't this make sense to you?
Right.
So that's one area that's changed, is the amount of information that's available and its accessibility. But the second area that's changed is, I think now with certain moral issues, in particular sexual and gender issues, we're at the point where feelings now often trump science.
Wow.
Feelings often trump science in the minds of this generation. It used to be, well, science says. Now people go, well, which science? There's so much fake news, who can I trust? But then there's a sense of, even if the science says, here's what my feelings tell me, I'm not going to listen to the science. This is a trend we're seeing increasingly, millennials, Gen Z, and younger generations.
And Sean, you interact a lot with our current youth culture, so it's good to hear you diagnosing some of the problems out there that could crop up in trying to communicate to the younger generation. So your book serves a continuing, has an important niche there, because other than a few tweaks on how you might come in with some new illustrations, your book will still help us to communicate to this younger generation with these two caveats of some of the changes that you're observing. So what else can you think of about your book, about the last 10 years? Why should we pick up your book now, and what use we should put it to today?
You know what? A couple of years ago, I contacted the publisher and I said, hey, could I get the rights for the book back and self-publish it and make a couple tweaks? And they weren't willing to give it back, which I understand, because it's still selling.
Okay.
It's actually still selling copies. And I interviewed Dembski, I don't know, maybe a year and a half ago on my blog, and he said, there's something about the way we've structured the book that I would not make any big changes to it. I would respond to a few new objections that are online. I would add some new evidence. I'd probably expand the section a little bit on theistic evolution and just explain the questions that raises for things like the historical Adam. Mm-hmm. But generally speaking, I think the book has weathered time really well. And I continue to hear from professors and students. In fact, a Christian school down the road where I live, he said their students look forward to that section the most, and they can really track with the arguments that are made in the book, Understand Intelligent Design. And I think they're fair to the other side. We don't set up any straw man. We include a lot of stories and examples, the kind that people can say, okay, I've heard about fine tuning. Now it makes sense to me. I've heard about DNA. Now I have a hook to explain this and understand it to people. Because that's what I'm most passionate about. I know people have different interests, but I want lay public and people who don't read these professional journals to at least understand the nature of the debate, the significance of the debate, and what is at stake. And I think when young people realize that, they really come alive and are willing to engage in these conversations thoughtfully.
Excellent. Well, I hope that after my first book comes out, 10 years later, I could say, hey, it's weathered well. So I'm taking notes here, Sean. Thank you for the interview. And again, we've mainly been talking about Understanding Intelligent Design. That's the title of Sean's 2008 book with William Dembski. Sean, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on. I'm a listener to this podcast, so it was a treat to get invited and to come on with you, Mike.
All right. Well, you take care, Sean.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.